Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Wednesday, February 15th, 2017. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, William Todd Hunt will be here to highlight the Orpheus Project's production of West Side Story. We'll talk with Robert Fagan and poets involved with the Convergence book. Lori Wilson will give us an update on the Red Cross. We'll get the details on the upcoming Downtown Restaurant Week. And we'll check in with Eagle Crest. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here, live and local on a Juno afternoon, currently 43 degrees at the Juno International Airport.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A Toronto judge has issued a landmark ruling in a class action lawsuit over the so-called 60 scoop. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the ruling found that the Canadian government failed to take reasonable steps to protect thousands of Native children.
The ruling puts an end to a long and bitterly fought court battle. The class action lawsuit was filed 8 years ago on behalf of 16,000 children in Ontario. They were among the thousands who were taken from their families and placed in foster care or adoptive non-Aboriginal homes. The lawsuit claimed harm to the children because of the loss of identity and culture, and for many it led to substance abuse, violence, and other social problems. The lawsuit was seeking $1.3 billion in compensation. Marcia Brown Martel of the Temagami First Nation was the lead plaintiff.
We got taken away from our families. We are placed in nothing that was similar to our language, our way of being, our way of thinking, and we didn't get to return home.
The judge also ruled that the government should have known of the harm that would come, and it breached its duty of care to those children. He rejected the government's argument that it was different times in the 1960s and that it acted in good faith at the time and could not have known of the harm that might come. And he said Native bands were not consulted about the child welfare program. Brown Martel and other survivors of the 60s scoop were ecstatic with the ruling.
It is a great day in Canada when Canada's judicial system chooses to say that our children are so valuable and sacred and precious that we will protect them by law.
Meanwhile, the Minister of Indigenous Affairs says absolutely there will be no appeal of the decision, and she wants to sit down with Native leaders to discuss compensation as soon as possible. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
National Congress of American Indians President Brian Cladisby says federal officials can learn lessons from the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
President Cladisby says Native Americans made their collective voices ring out on the Dakota Access Pipeline.
This has been one issue that has galvanized not only Indian country, but the world.
Cladisby says the company didn't treat tribes fairly from the start of the project, which they first proposed placing above Bismarck.
And the people of Bismarck says, no, we don't want this pipeline above our city because you might contaminate our water supply. So the company made the decision to move that pipeline a half a mile in front of an Indian reservation.
Cladisby says the federal government needs to learn from this dispute.
Let us be at the table early in the process because we can show you what happens when tribes are not at the table.
The new chair of the Senate Indian Affairs Committee, John Hoven of North Dakota, says despite differences with the Republican Party over the pipeline, he believes he'll be able to work well with tribes on energy issues.
Confident that even despite the diversity of views on issues such as Dakota Access Pipeline, we can work together and we will work together on the federal regulatory process.
Hoven says he understands that tribes need a seat at the table earlier in the process.
Going forward, we can review the permitting process to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to be heard and that a fair, certain, and legal process is followed.
And Mel Sheldon, chairman of the Tulalip tribes, says the fight over the Dakota Access Pipeline is far from over.
And if we don't get a resolve, I'm sure that the protests this summer are going to be much larger.
For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting,
the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at RamonaFarms.com. Support by the Fred Jones Jr. Museum of Art at the University of Oklahoma. Photosynthesis, new photographs by Navajo Will Wilson, plus early works by Edward Curtis. Photosynthesis through April 2nd. Info at fjjma.ou.edu.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, February 15th, 2017, about 6 minutes after the hour. Scott Burton, your host, and joining me now in the studio is William Todd Hunt. He is the artistic director of the Orpheus Project, and we're going to be talking about their production of West Side Story coming up at JDHS. Welcome to the show, William Todd Hunt.
Thanks so much, Scott.
Yeah, it's
you
nice
can just
to have
call
you
me
here.
Todd. That's okay.
Okay. William Todd Hunt.
I know,
though.
Right? It's a stage name
it's
thing.
It's great. Okay, so we were just talking. Orpheus Project used to be Opera To Go.
Right.
We'll start there.
Okay, sure. So a lot of you probably know of Opera To Go. I hope so, anyway. And, you know, through the years, we've done a lot of opera, and we've started to do more than that. So we've branched out into helping other organizations put on musical productions or concerts and that kind of thing. And also we've sort of curtailed our touring some. So it seems that the name Opera To Go wasn't as, you know, descriptive of what we actually do. So we're looking for other names that with a little bit more broad sense of what we do. And Orpheus, of course, being the mythological person who is a singer, an instrumentalist so wonderful that, you know, he could, you know, make rocks weep. I think it's like the most ridiculous thing, but it's like this seriously great musician. And it sort of seemed perfect for kind of what we want to do, a little bit more broad, instrumental and vocal, concert and theatrical. So.
Okay, so Orpheus Project. Remind us what your last production was.
So our last big production was last year, which was the Monteverdi L'Orfeo, which, of course, is the 1607 opera version of the Orpheus legend.
Okay, and now West Side Story.
And now West Side Story. So we're just, like, hitting all of the corners. The year before that, we did Janáček, which is an early 20th century opera. I like to program things that people wouldn't normally see on stage or bring new things. So West Side Story isn't a new thing to a lot of people, but it's definitely something people should experience. A wonderful piece, but it's also, as we're discovering, fiendishly difficult to produce. So it doesn't get done as often as you might think.
It also seems somehow very appropriate for right now.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Right?
I mean, the themes, and it's not just for right now. I mean, things have gotten better, and then they get worse, and things get better, and then they get worse with, like, race relations is what we're talking about. And, you know, there's just a lot of that in the media right now. And so when we decided to do that, it wasn't as bad of a time. But, yeah, it's it seems to be something that is unfortunately appropriate for us to have in our face at any point in time.
If somebody hasn't seen West Side Story in a while, can you give us the plot in broad strokes?
So the broad stroke is if you know the story of Romeo and Juliet, that's what this is. And that's what the old Jerome Robbins is. The whole show is sort of his idea. Take a Romeo and Juliet and set it in some place that is meaningful to people nowadays being the 1950s. But it's still good today. So it's set in the west side of Manhattan. That's the West Side Story. And there's a man or a boy, really, from an American. You know, he was born in America, even though his parents are immigrants. And then you have the Puerto Ricans, who are very new to the area. And there's a woman, Maria, who they fall in love. And it's just like the Montagues and the Capulets. Their families are like, whoa, you cannot do this. this is terrible and completely unnatural and wrong. And they persist, and, well, and then people die. And it's totally Shakespeare with unbelievably fantastic music.
Okay. So beyond being artistic director of mm-hmm. Orpheus Project, you're going to be conducting and producing this show. You
right.
are conducting and producing. Mm-hmm. Tell us, who are some of the other players?
So Haley Duran is maybe the next person to mention. She's the choreographer. And anybody, you know, if you've seen the movie, because the movie came out a few years after the Broadway production, it's full of this amazing dance, and that's basically what we're doing. Everybody on stage dances and has to dance a lot, and so that's been a real focus of our rehearsals so far. I can't even describe. I don't even know how our cast is doing it. It's amazing. My jaw is on the floor every day for some of the things they do, and then they spin around and then they sing. It's completely amazing. But yeah, Haley's been doing a great job with that, and she is reconstructing Jerome Robbins' choreography. So it's the original choreography. We're doing pretty much the whole thing. I mean, you know, she changes things as necessary, and our stage isn't quite as big, and we don't have quite as many people, so there's some things that are different, but that's huge. Julie O'Connor is doing our scene directing, so there's spoken dialogue in between a lot of the scenes, and so she's working on that. Shelley Wright is doing our costumes. I'm light designing, that kind of thing. So it's a nice, tight family production for what we're doing.
And how about, I'm thinking of, you know, the Jets and the Sharks. Who's playing who?
Oh, sure. So I should mention our Tony is the only person in the cast from out of town. So we've hired Gilad Paz, who's come to us from New York, to do the role of Tony, which is really great. He just got here 4 or 5 days ago, so we're plugging him into everything that we've done. Let's see, Jess Skiba is our Maria, and she's local. If you've seen shows in the past couple of years, there's a good chance you've seen her in that. Alicia Fulberg is our Anita. Nathan Buendia is Bernardo. And it's a Riff is, this is actually kind of cool. So Riff, the leader of the Jets, is Taylor Vidic. And right, Scott just went, what, really? It's like, that's right. So we've taken a little bit of a turn here, and actually wasn't going to talk about it, but now I guess I am. The leader of the Jet gang is a woman, and we're not playing her as a man. It's a woman is, you know, in charge of the Jets, and a man is in charge of the Sharks, and we have women in both sides. So it's kind of interesting. It's been really fun talking about this in rehearsal because to us, it really takes us into a different place than we think of the 1950s, but we've decided this is just a different 1950s, and by getting rid of gender issues and making it a completely even playing field, I think we're actually focusing more on the real issues behind the drama, which is racism. And yeah, I mean, it could draw more attention just because of that, but I think the way we're playing it, it flows seamlessly. This is a real world to the people on stage, and I find it really exciting, actually. I was a little uncomfortable, you know, a couple months ago or whenever we were doing the casting, but I really come to love it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Taylor Vidic, extraordinarily talented.
Right, and it's like, well, of course, she's Riff.
Wow.
I mean,
interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, there's some things, little plot points to iron out, like if you know the show Anybody's, that character's a girl who wants to be in the gang. And so we have to sort of massage over that and just make it, you know, because Anybody's is really young and isn't tough enough. She's not in the gang. It's not because she's a girl. That sort of thing. So, yeah, it's actually really exciting, and I find kind of liberating.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Details, when does it open?
Oh, right. We got to talk about that. So it opens a week from Saturday. So that is the 25th of February. And it runs, so it's 7:30 on Saturday the 25th, 3 o'clock on Sunday the 26th. And then there's only two more performances the following weekend on Friday at 7:30. At 7:30 on Friday the 3rd.
Yep, I think I have down 3rd and 4th.
Okay, I didn't write anything down, so yep. I'm doing this off the top of my head. So the 3rd and the 4th is Saturday, that's right, at 7:30. So only four shows at JDHS.
And I had no problem finding the Orpheus Project on Facebook, and mm-hmm. the event is yep. there. So if you need those details again.
Yeah, go ahead and like us on Facebook. I'm trying to post a picture or a little video or something every day as a teaser to... You can see the progress as it goes along. Most of that's on Facebook. We also have our website, orpheusproject.org, or the old operatogo.net still works as well. And you can get tickets on there. You can get tickets at the Jack. You can get tickets at the bookstores, all the normal places. And there's a discount for getting your tickets early. It's $2, I think. So,
if we have a listener out there who might be on the fence about going, what would you tell them?
I would say that you don't get much, you know, very many opportunities to see this. I wasn't say unless you're in New York, but, you know, you don't see it that often in New York either. So it really is such a wonderful piece. I'm personally not a big fan of music theater myself. I'm, you know, born and bred in opera, but this has always been on my list to do for decades. The music is wonderful, and that's actually why we're doing it. And the dance is amazing, and that's another reason that we should do it. So if you're into music, theater, dance, this is for you because it's really got it all in, yeah, big time.
All right. Todd Hunt, he's the artistic director for the Orpheus Project and the West Side Story. West Side Story opens a week from this Saturday. Find out more information on Facebook or the other sites that Todd mentioned. Todd, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks,
sounds really great.
Yeah.
You have pride.
No.
long as you stay on your own side.
Free to be anything you choose.
Free to wear devils and shine shoes.
Everywhere crime in America. Organized crime in America. Terrible time in America.
You forget I'm in America.
I go back to San Juan.
I know a boat you can get on. Bye-bye.
Everyone there will give big cheer.
Hey! Everyone there will have moved here.
This is Bird Note. If you've ever seen an ostrich egg in a museum or a souvenir shop, you'll know they're big, nearly 6 inches long, and they're heavy. Live ostrich eggs weigh about 3 pounds, the same as about 24 large chicken eggs. But what bird laid the largest eggs ever known? To date, the record holder is the now extinct elephant bird. They were enormous. The flightless bird stood nearly 10 feet tall and weighed in at around half a ton. Up to the late 1600s, elephant birds lived on the island of Madagascar, but by the 1700s, they were extinct. Some of their eggshells survived, though, and they dwarf an ostrich egg, measuring 13 inches long and tipping the scales at around 22 pounds. That's about 24 chicken eggs. Elephant birds belong to a bird group called the ratites. They were relatives of other large, flightless birds, including the present-day ostrich, emu, cassowaries, and rheas, and the much smaller kiwis, 12 living species in all. But when elephant bird DNA was analyzed, it turned out that the huge bird's closest living relatives are those diminutive kiwis, the largest of which stands a modest 18 inches tall. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
This broadcast is sponsored in part by Ron's Apothecary at the Mendenhall Mall. Serving Juneau since 1978, Ron's Apothecary is providing medication information, nutritional supplements, and homeopathic remedies. More information at ronsapothecary.com.
You're listening to a Juneau afternoon here on February 15th, 2017. It's about 25 minutes after the top of the hour. Scott Burton, your host today, and joining me now in the studio is poet Robert Fagan, and we're going to be talking about the Convergence book. Welcome to the show, Robert.
Well, thanks, Scott. It's really good to be here.
Yeah. This is an interesting project. It's a collaboration. Tell us about how it came to be.
Well, the idea for this book was born at the Juneau Airport last spring when I was coming back from a trip outside and I saw an exhibit of student artworks from the Juneau School District. And these were wonderful pieces of student work, and I saw three whose artists I'd known for many years because we'd all performed in the Juneau Dance Theater Nutcracker together. I'd always wanted to write poems that were based on specific works of art, and I saw this as something that was organic and practical and rooted in Juneau and in the two cultures of Europe and Native Alaska. So I went home and I started writing, and to my surprise and delight, when I talked with the girls, their families, and their art teachers, we all found ourselves on the same page. So to do this, we needed a press, and I'd been talking for a number of years with Juno poets, particularly at UAS, about something more enduring than the title Echoes magazine, doing an anthology or a one-author book if somebody had a big body of work. And then Dream Farm Press came along just in time. I had a lot of help. I could never have done this on my own, because in addition to the wonderful families and their totally inspiring art teachers, Alaska Litho helped with the production of the book. They recommended my book designer, Maggie Frank, of the Franco design firm, Art Such, who's also a dance dad, did our pictures, and my friend from 50 years ago, middle school, Roger Lathbury, of Orchises Press in Washington, D.C., advised me on how a newbie in the publishing business can roll up his sleeves and jump in and not drown.
Okay, so these are ekphrastic poems, correct me if I'm wrong, that you wrote about these students' work. Can you give us a few of the examples of the artists that inspired you, who you wrote about?
Well, Luna Ewing is a dancer. She's 12 and an eighth grader at DZ. A grandchild of Mary Jane Valentine, how could she not weave? So she did a weaving, and her teacher, Maya Lager, chose it for the exhibit. Her family has done many things in the history of Alaska and the Yukon, going all the way back to the celebrated Hlunaat, that's six generations, who was one of the heroes of the Packer War and one of the Tlingit people who taught John Muir the ecology lesson he'd never forget. So that's Luna, and she can't be here right now because she's going to be dancing at the Innovation Summit tonight with her friends from Juneau Dance Theater. Roxy Simons is a ninth grader at TMHS. She's interested in everything, and especially in hiking the trails of Juneau and Idaho with her best friends. And she's also very interested in cosmology, the neurosciences, and the interface between the two. And she was one of those perceptive students who saw merit in the idea that's circulating now, that there are deep parallels between brain, mind, and the universe. And that's her picture. I mean, Roxy did what's called a Zentangle, which is a special type of art form design with shapes enclosed in boundaries. To Roxy, these shapes were universes in a multi-world cosmology, and they were colliding and interacting. And I thought, wow, how many eighth graders, which is what she was when she did this at Floyd, draw a picture of the universe that resonates with the newest and most original ideas in cosmology, high energy physics, and neurosciences. This is something that I'm sure in part I was reading into the picture because it was so true to what little physics I can understand. But the idea of colliding universes was entirely hers. And how can you not write a poem about that? And then there's Bridget Gehring, who was one of the performers in William Todd Hunt's Orfeo last year, and who's currently a cheerleader at TMHS and can't take full credit for the boys' exciting wins last weekend over Ketchikan, but I'm sure she deserves some of the credit along with her teammates on the cheer squad. And she made a mask that represented the mystery of life, past, present, and future, who I was, who I am, who I will be, the questions that life asks, and the challenges that I've faced and overcome. I mean, it's a mask that tells the story of an eventful and courageous and very promising life, and how can you not write a poem about that? So I had plenty of material. The only problem was to get it under control so it wouldn't go every which way and put it in a format that was appropriate, respectful, and good for a Juno audience.
Okay. You don't happen to have an example of your work with you here, do you?
Well, I'd like just to read a little bit of one of the poems. These are all works in progress. This is the poem for Luna's Weaving, and this is just one of the verses because it's a lot longish and airtime is precious. So the title is Weaver Girl or Not, and the background is that in traditional Thlinget culture, asking questions and talking about the future is a sensitive matter. And when I asked Luna if she was going to be a weaver like her grandma, she said the culturally correct thing, which was, I don't know. So I thought, oh, great, there's a poem, Weaver Girl or Not. And it starts, Grandma Mary Jane was a celebrated weaver in Clequan, but paths fork, and there are many worlds to choose from. You can dance to the stars. You can bring back a flying squirrel nest, or a red queen, or a pair of point shoes. Nobody knows what the future will bring.
Thank you for sharing that with us. Robert, if somebody wanted to get a copy of Convergence or learn more about it, how can they do that?
Well, for starters, there's a very informative and well-reported article about the book and the authors in this week's Capital City Weekly. It's free. You can pick up a copy or two or three if you want. And then if you're interested in actually seeing a copy of the book and maybe even buying it, they're on sale at Hearthside Books, at Kindred Post, and at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council's Jack Bookstore. They're $5 a piece with color illustrations printed on high-quality, glossy stock. And I'm certainly delighted. For me, as a publisher, the best part of the month is when I send out the royalty checks. And so far, we haven't missed a single month.
Okay. Aside from that, Robert, to go out, tell us what you're most proud of about this publication.
Well, what I'm most proud of is that we were all able to work as a team to make it happen. This was a community effort. It's rooted in Juneau, and I feel that it says something important about the arts in Juneau and art education in particular. The art programs in the Juneau schools are legendary. You know, in my time here, which isn't that long, they go back to Tom Manning and his students, and I'm sure it goes back a lot farther than that. You know, if you have to make tough choices when budgets are shrinking, you know, when you've got something that's working, that's where you invest. That's just sound financial management. And yeah, I just really want to shout out for the arts programs in the Juneau schools and the arts opportunities that our homeschool students have as well.
Okay. Are you going to have a signing in the near future?
Yeah, we're on at Hearthside Books' Third Thursday series tomorrow night at 6:30 at Hearthside in the Valley. We'll have readings, a chance to meet the authors, some fun writing projects, and a little sneak preview of the title on Dream Farm Press's list for next year. To the best of my knowledge, the up-to-date information that I have is that all three authors, in addition to myself, expect to be there. And that's a good thing because I really don't want to do all the talking.
All right. So, again, that's tomorrow night, Thursday, at the Valley Hearthside in the Nugget Mall.
Yeah.
Okay. Robert Fagan, thank you so much for coming in. We've been talking about Convergence. You can get it, probably a signed copy, and learn a lot more about all of these artists tomorrow, Thursday night, 6:30 at Hearthside. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Scott. It's been a pleasure to be here.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 15th of February, 2017. It was on this date, 1898, the battleship USS Maine exploded in the harbor in Havana. It was there to show support for Cuba's movement for independence from Spain. A massive explosion late at night, 260 crew members were killed. Spain denied that it had anything to do with the explosion, but the American public was outraged. Newspapers ran sensational headlines, the Hearst papers in particular, and Congress issued a declaration of war against Spain in April. The Spanish-American War was very short. Spain asked for peace in July, and they gave up the Philippines, Guam, and Puerto Rico. Cuba gained independence. Nobody is sure what caused the explosion that sank the Maine. Some believe it was a fire in the coal bunker aboard the ship, but there is some evidence to suggest that it may have been a mine after all. It's the birthday of Susan B. Anthony, born in Adams, Massachusetts, 1820, pioneer in the women's suffrage movement. And it's because of her and others allied with her, including Elizabeth Cady Stanton, that women have the right to speak in public and serve on committees and keep their wages and guardianship of their children and vote. She was also an advocate for equal pay for equal work. Her father was a Quaker and a cotton manufacturer. They were abolitionists. Later, Susan B. Anthony became a teacher at a Quaker boarding school in Philadelphia, where she earned a good deal less than male teachers, and that started her thinking about the wrongs that women were suffering in life. So she began speaking in public about equal rights for women. Joined up with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, and the two of them were inseparable until the day Stanton died. Stanton and her husband always set aside a room for Susan B. Anthony to stay in. Anthony never married, though she did take care of Stanton's children. Susan B. Anthony gave hundreds of lectures every year, many of them shut down by mobs throwing rotten eggs at her. There was fights in the audience, benches broken. She was arrested for attempting to vote in Rochester, New York. She was convicted and fined, never paid the fine. She was often asked why she never married, and she said, "It always happened that the men I wanted were those I could not get, and those who wanted me I couldn't have." And then later she said, "I never found the man who was necessary to my happiness. I was very well as I was." And towards the end of her life, she said, "I never felt I could give up my life of freedom to become a man's housekeeper. When I was young, if a girl married poor, she became a housekeeper and a drudge. If she married wealth, she became a pet and a doll. Just think, had I married at 20, I would have been a drudge or a doll for 59 years. Think of it." It's the birthday of the composer and pianist Harold Arlen, born Hyman Arluck in Buffalo, New York, 1905, who wrote the music for Between the Devil and the Deep Blue Sea and It's Only a Paper Moon and Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Here's a poem for today by Louise Glick, First Snow. Like a child, the earth's going to sleep, or so the story goes. But I'm not tired, it says, and the mother says, "You may not be tired, but I'm tired." You can see it in her face, everyone can. So the snow has to fall, sleep has to come, because the mother's sick to death of her life and needs silence. First Snow by Louise Glick, from her poems 1962 to 2012, published by Frere, Strauss, and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, you can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
What is civility? Does it matter? Are Alaskans more civil? The University of Alaska Southeast MPA program hosts a discussion of civility in the last frontier with Alaskan leaders Mayor Mike Navarre, journalist Dermot Cole, and Senators Anna McKinnon and Berta Gardner. Join the discussion in person at 360 on February 23rd at 5:30 p.m. or join the discussion online at 360north.org.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, February 15th, 2017. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 18 minutes until the top of the hour. Joining me on the show now is Lori Wilson. She's the executive director of the Tanana Valley and Juno branch of the Red Cross.
Yes, there you go. Yep.
Did I get it right?
Yes.
Okay, welcome to the show, Lori. Help us understand what the Red Cross is. I think we all have an impression, but tell us, school us a little bit.
Where to start? But okay, so the Red Cross has, we have seven tenets. The three most predominant that you'll hear about the most is humanitarian. We are a humanitarian network, international humanitarian network. So our first and primary goal is to serve those in need when they, in a time of emergency. It's particularly you'll see us, we're best known for, when you see the big disasters, the hurricanes and the tornadoes and such, setting up shelters. But there's a lot of other things. There's the day-to-day responses when you have home fires or if you have, mudslides or flooding or things like that to where you lose your home. So it's the day-to-day individuals. It could be that to being providing care to, internationally in terms of refugees and family assistance shelters in the case of large, if we were to have a huge, large community shooting, things like that. There's a lot of things that happen behind the scenes that we do that you never see in the news.
And so you're a nonprofit,
right? We're a nonprofit, and that's the other part. We are not a federally funded agency. We are completely neutral and impartial. And by not being a federal agency, like so many people think we are, because of our relationship with the government, we actually receive less federal funds than probably most nonprofits that Very little of our money comes from the federal government. It comes from individuals, corporations, foundations, in order to do the work that we do. That allows us to maintain our neutrality and impartiality. We are not beholden to any government. The downside to that is we don't get federal funds, so when there's huge disasters that cost in the millions and billions of dollars, that's coming from donors to take care of. The good news to that is it allows us to move and do what we need to do when we need to do it, how we need to do it, and not have to answer to the federal government in terms of how we've spent their money.
Got it. What is your connection with the federal government, though?
So we have a congressional charter. We are a congressionally chartered agency. We don't have an Articles of Incorporation like most. We are a congressional charter, which also means we have a congressional mandate with our charter. Our charter is a little bit more unusual than other congressionally chartered agencies in that we also have a mandate to provide service. So we are the agency that is called in any large-scale disasters first. We are to be the coordinating agency. We might not provide all of the assistance, but we're the coordinating agency. And then that also means for the service to the armed forces, all of emergency communications go through the Red Cross to be validated and confirmed so that military members can return home to their families in a time of emergency.
And, you know, how you may be most visible in Juneau, for me anyway, mm-hmm. my neighbors had a fire,
yeah.
and you were there within hours helping them figure out where they're going to stay that night and how yeah. they were going to eat. How else might we see you in town?
Well, it is the day-to-day thing. So, you know, there's the home fire, so when there's something happens, but there's also the preparedness piece. So we have the national agency as a whole, we are working on getting smoke alarms in people's homes. So you can call our office and you can set up appointments, and we will, our staff and volunteers will set up an appointment and we'll come to your home. We'll evaluate what you have. We'll see, do you have enough smoke alarms? Do the smoke alarms you have still work? And that doesn't mean do they go off when you test them. That means how old are they? Because they do expire after 7 to 10 years. The sensors can start going bad. So we will replace and add however many you need at no cost. In addition, we talk about what your evacuation plan is, and we look at your emergency plan and help you think about what it is you would do in the case of a fire, because we want you to have every opportunity to get out safely. The little tricks that we learn, like don't stand up when you hear the smoke alarm, when you're laying in bed, don't stand up, get out of bed and crawl.
Yeah.
Those things that you do in the practice. In addition, there's the pillowcase where we are working with the schools to teach students about preparedness and what they would do in a case of emergency. If they had to go to a shelter, what would they want with them? What would make them feel safe? And so they can make their own preparedness kit in a nice little pillowcase that's provided by Disney that
and
they
tie
decorate
it to a stick.
And tie it to a stick.
All very worthy endeavors. And people can support you by going to your fundraiser this Friday, right?
Yes. We have our 100-year centennial. 100-year centennial, duh, that's kind of redundant, celebration and fundraiser at the Elizabeth Paradovich Hall at 7. Doors open at 6. So you can mix and mingle, and dinner will start at 7. We have a little program. The Lieutenant Governor has graciously agreed to come be our keynote speaker. So we will have that, and then some dancing afterwards. Your Alaskan DJ, Vic Lemer, is going to be providing the music and entertainment. And silent auction. We are also doing a cryout auction for a 7-day Caribbean cruise accompanied with 2 Alaska Airlines tickets to get you there.
Sounds really
nice.
So,
you know,
right,
you can
now
come and have a chance. I know, right? You can come and have a chance to win a really great trip and help the Red Cross while you're doing it.
You probably already mentioned it, but is dinner involved?
It's a buffet dinner provided by Abby's Kitchen.
Oh,
so
yum.
It even gets even better, see?
Yeah. So again, doors at 6 and starts at 7?
Starts at 7. Dinner starts at 7. It's $75. You can get tickets through the Jack, through their online or at their office, or Hearthside Books or Rainbow Retreat.
If somebody wants more information, where should they go?
They can give me a call on my cell phone, 347-8266.
Okay.
I'm running around town delivering tickets all over the place. Please call.
And website or Facebook as well?
You can go to our Facebook as well. We have an event set up there, and you can follow the link right on through.
Just Red Cross Alaska? Or?
Yeah, so it's the Red Cross of Alaska Facebook, if
okay.
you find us. Yep.
Lori Wilson, thanks for coming on the show. Thanks. Fundraiser for the Red Cross, the centennial, this Friday night at the Elizabeth Paratrovich Hall, 6 o'clock. Support the Red Cross.
Great.
Thank you so much. listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Wednesday, February 15th, 2017, about 9 minutes until the top of the hour. And it's time for our weekly check-in with Eagle Crest, Matt Lillard, Jeff Reclow. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us this afternoon, Scott.
It's nice to have you here. Let's see, it's your weekend, right? So you're getting ready for Powder Thursday tomorrow
getting
morning.
Getting ready for Powder Thursday. I'm not sure we'll have Powder Thursday tomorrow, but anything can happen. But I think the forecast that I saw might have a little bit of sunshine. But
Cooling down a little bit.
Looks like a great weekend ahead of us. And it is a three-day weekend, President's Weekend, so people can get up there and ski all 3 days. And the snow bus will be running Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. So I just wanted to start out right and get that word out there. And you can find that bus schedule at skijuno.com.
Excellent. What else is going on in the mountain?
Yeah, I think just we came off of last weekend. We got a big thump of snow on Saturday into Sunday. And Sunday was a really interesting day, a lot of really good skiing on 22 inches of snow, which kind of fell overnight, which always makes things kind of kind of jumbled from an operations standpoint, but everybody pulled together and we got off, the bulk of the day, had some really, really fun turns. And so coming into this weekend, we're really kind of starting to turn the clock towards spring. We're going longer days, so starting tomorrow, all lifts operate until 4 p.m. for the first time all year, so people can come up and enjoy, skiing later into the afternoon. As Jeff mentioned, I think tomorrow we're going to see temps cool off a little bit, but not too much. So, temps in the low to mid-30s and potential for some sunshine. I think I saw some more light driving in today than I've seen the past 2 days. So it looks like it is starting to clear out. And then looks like some snow Thursday into Friday. And then come Saturday, Sunday, it might start clearing again and get some more sun. So we're looking for a great weekend. That spring skiing's right around the corner. We still got about a third of our season left. Hoping for some really more, some more great days and kick it off with a good weekend this weekend.
Never too late for some lessons.
Never too late for some lessons. So we still have plenty of time to learn how to ski and snowboard if that's what you're interested in for this season, and we encourage you to get out there. This weekend is our last weekend for our We Ski program for this session, our Little Tykes or Little Rippers program. So this will be week 6 for those programs, and we have a new session that will start next weekend on February 25th and 26th. So plenty of time to get out there and take some lessons. And we're also starting to, as Matt says, our days start getting longer, so we're starting to move into some events up on the mountains. So we're starting to look forward to our Porcupine Rail Jam, which will be on February 25th up on the bottom of Muskeg. And it'll just be just a great time to come up and ride the rails and get going, and it'll start the kickoff of our terrain park series. It'll go on into March.
So that's probably a week from Saturday?
A week from Saturday. So
will we see you next week to remind us? I can't remember.
Yes, we will.
Okay.
Yeah, so, but I just wanted to put a bug in that ear. And,
yeah.
And then, with March comes, again, as Matt said, longer days, and we'll be open for during the spring break holidays and more events. And so it's going to be a great time up on the mountain. And it is still winter up there. Sometimes it's hard to tell when you're down here, but we do have plenty of snow up on the mountain.
If somebody's never been skiing or snowboarding before, tell us, how long does it take for them to get up? Like, if they come up to the mountain, walk us through what they're going to, how easy or how hard it is to get up there.
Well, we recommend taking a lesson. So you come up to the mountain, just come right into the main floor of the Porcupine Lodge, and you'll sign up for your lesson, get your rental form, and then head up into the rental shop. And we can equip you with skis, boots, and poles if you're going to ski, or snowboard and boots if you're going to learn how to snowboard. And then from right up there, you head right out to the meeting area, hook up with your instructor, and in just a couple, 2 short hours, you can be actually up there sliding down the snow, working with gravity instead of against gravity, and working towards controlling your speed, either with wedge if you're skiing, or just little turns, even if you're skiing or snowboarding, and heading over to the lift. So, and what we recommend is we have a great package. It's a triple play learner's pack, which is 3 lessons, 3 lower mountain lift tickets, and 3 equipment rentals. And that really gets you going. You can do it 3 days in a row, 3 weeks in a row, or, well, you don't have enough time to do it 3 months in a row. But that's a great way to get you started.
Okay. For more information, where should people go?
SkiJuno.com. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat.
And lifts open what time tomorrow?
9 a.m., so 9 till 4 for all 4 lifts starting tomorrow for the rest of the season.
Well, great. Matt and Jeffrey, anything else you want to add?
Nope. Just remember, it's still winter on the mountain, even though it doesn't look like it down here. So come on up and make some turns with us.
Thanks, you too. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today. Tomorrow, we'll learn about the Pick Quick Give program. We'll find out about Saturday's meeting. We'll find out more about the meeting for Friends of Admiralty Island and Sunday's community celebration for Veterans for Peace. We'll get a preview of Bill Fleming's Alaska Bicycle Trek. And Nancy DeCherney will be here with Arts News during Arts Up. It's currently 44 degrees at the Juneau International Airport, and looking at the forecast for tonight, calls for scattered showers before 9 p.m. with patchy fog between 9 and midnight, patchy freezing fog after midnight, otherwise partly cloudy with a low around 30. Tomorrow, Thursday, calls for patchy freezing fog before 9 a.m., it could possibly mean some black ice, so look out for that. Sunny, otherwise, with a high near 38. And going into Friday, scattered snow showers before noon, then scattered rain and snow. Cloudy with a high near 37. Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.